Welcome back to the Dealmakers Podcast Show with serial entrepreneur Alejandro Cremades, best-selling author of The Art of Startup Fundraising and co-founder at Panthera Advisors. In this podcast, we ask our guests about their successful acquisitions and financing rounds.
Alrighty, hello everyone, and welcome to the Dealmaker Show. So today we have an exciting founder. We're going to be talking about the building, the scaling, financing, exiting. I mean, all of the above. You know, we're going to be diving into how his experience at Tesla was, where he actually spent over 7 years. Incredible, you know, people building things there. We're going to be talking too about how to win in the world of robotics and what needs to be done there, and then also what it takes to build a world-class team. You know, we're going to be talking about raising money, the whole exit. I mean, brace yourself for a very inspiring conversation. And without further ado, let's welcome our guest today, Chris Walty. Welcome to the show.
Thank you, Alejandro, for hosting me.
So, originally born and raised in Alexandria, Virginia, give us a walk through memory lane. How was life growing up for you?
Life was, we moved around a lot. I was an only child. My father was in the military, and then we moved every, 2 years after he retired from the military, and ended up going to high school in Plano, Texas, graduated one of 1,800, largest class in the country, played a few sports there, and yeah, went to Illinois after that. I wanted to be an architect, but I couldn't draw, so I decided engineering was kind of the next best thing. Central Illinois seemed to be a great place, number two double E school in the country there, and had a blast. That kind of takes me up to when I started working. Happy to kind of fill in more details of the past, or we can branch off from there.
Well, I mean, it sounds like you moved quite a bit, growing up, and I'm sure that that has shaped who you are today. Because, I mean, moving, new friends, new environments, dealing with uncertainty. Now you're dealing with uncertainty on a daily basis as a founder. So how do you think that shaped who you are today?
You learn not to hold on to too much of the past and look to the future. I mean, when you're a very little kid, it's not like you're developing super deep friendships when you're 4 years old and, pulling each other's hair. But, as you get older, those friendships start to matter a little bit more. But every 2 years, we ended up moving to a different state. And so you kind of look for, what are the important things that I value in friendships or the community or, the sports teammates, et cetera. And you learn to be pretty resilient. And so, there's a few folks I still keep in touch with from high school. But not too many. Out of the 1,800, it's a very, very small percentage. And I guess it also gives you a little bit of an opportunity to continually reinvent yourself for better or worse. And so, I think it, in the world of startups, Eric Ries, Lean Startup, your job is not to build a product, but is to learn what customers want. In some way, moving a lot kind of gives you an opportunity to almost try that as a person, right?
So I guess, out of all things engineering, what got you into electrical engineering?
Well, I wanted to build stuff. I knew that was my future. I considered going to the military and following in his steps in the Air Force. But, I felt like I was sort of put on this planet to make things. And I didn't know exactly what I wanted to make. But, when you factor in software all the way through mechanical, if you kind of spread the spectrum of engineering disciplines, electrical is almost right in the middle there. It does touch some of the low level software aspects, assembly, learned assembly in college, but also, touches, there's mechanical aspects of the where electrons flow and structures that support that and, thermal and heat management, et cetera. So it seemed like kind of the right middle ground. I've always tried to kind of navigate, in hindsight, I probably should have been a systems engineer or a general engineer. Because I found my interests and passions and strengths lie in kind of the overlap and the integration of a lot of these different engineering disciplines versus going, super deep in any one particular one.
So in your case, you ended up, going into university there, studying electrical engineering and then doing, a bunch of, stuff, like doing consulting and, even working at a Spanish company. So what do you think were the immediate steps that need to happen for you to ultimately become an entrepreneur, which ended up being the case with TasteBot Technologies?
Yeah, I mean, half the battle is knowing where the opportunity is, understanding customer pain, having some experience, right? I think there's a lot of startups, a lot of folks that are building hammers looking for nails. I think really to really create the right company, a meaningful, lasting, generational company, you really have to have deep understanding of the problem. And it's tough to do that, you know, immediately out of school. And so, you know, I went into renewable energy after experiencing, you know, working with oil and gas companies and renewable companies alike, realizing, hey, there's a huge lack of energy storage. For us to get more renewables on the grid that are non-dispatchable, we need to create an element of dispatchability. We need to be able to store this commodity. Electricity is the only commodity, basically produced and consumed in real time. Corn, you know, hydrocarbons, rice, fabrics are all consumed, are all produced and decoupled from the consumption. So getting back to, you know, what it takes to be, or how that applies to entrepreneurship is really deep understanding of a problem, of an industry, of a pain point, and the ability to build a great team around that problem to tackle whatever engineering or go-to-market disciplines are needed.
So then, with the company, with TasteBot Technologies, which was the first rodeo, how did you get going with the business? I mean, what pushed you, especially after having been for a bunch of years already, you know, in the workforce, you know, what pushed you into becoming an entrepreneur?
Yeah, so clean tech was humming along from kind of 2007, 2008, all the way through, you know, 2012, and then took a little bit of a downturn. There was a bit of a correction in the market, and I felt that was a great time to start a company. A good friend of mine from college and I it was a little bit of not taking my own advice here, but we really wanted to build something, and we found the best opportunity that we believed could be solved through technology, which was effectively quantifying psychographics. Typically, consumers with psychographics, well, it's like consumer preferences, tastes, hence TasteBud. But you know, most websites and marketers make decisions based on demographics. So, like, you're a 30-year-old female living in the suburbs. Like, therefore, you must want to buy this, or you must want to take this trip, or you must like this type of food. When in reality, it's like, you know, it's not a very good predictor. And so we kind of were brainstorming actually in Spain while we were both traveling there, and came up with what we believed was a very novel way to do this, quantify psychographics, team up with an expert in this field, and then started the company together. That kind of took us through the next 2 years.
So you guys, you know, raised a little of money there. You know, you guys did this for about close to 4 years. And then eventually you go through an acquisition. What was that acquisition process like? Because, I mean, first company, first exit, you know, I think that an exit is always an exit, right? Especially if it's the first rodeo. So, I mean, that's pretty amazing.
Yeah, ultimately it was a very reasonable outcome. You know, some of the challenges with not being an expert in consumer marketing, et cetera, coming in were, you know, we didn't really understand the ideal business model. Like, we built a really cool technology. In fact, you know, we were in discussions with Amazon, and they had us, you know, compared side by side with their product recommendation engine. And we were, you know, with vastly less amount of information on the customers, like, we're making very, very good recommendations compared to their recommendation engine. But ultimately, it wasn't really clear what the right business model was. So we ended up finding a great customer in a brick and mortar retail shopping center owner, and had a series of properties. And, you know, brick and mortar retail at the time was, you know, undergoing a lot of transformation, the threat, you know, people were buying more and more things online. And they're like, how do we take the best of what consumers can do online and apply that in the physical environment? So it was a great opportunity to apply our technology with a very eager customer. We ended up being profitable, but ultimately it sort of took us down a path where we were very, very, very focused on that one customer, almost to the point where we're almost more like a service provider than a product company. And ultimately, my co-founder and I decided, you know, there were other problems that we felt were just bigger to solve. So we ended up selling that company to a company called Raise. Tyler stayed on, led a lot of the digital efforts, and again, ended up becoming their CTO. And I moved out to California to join my old friend Cal Langton at Tesla, who was leading the supercharging team at the time.
I mean, Tesla there, I mean, you were for over 7 years before you got going, you know, with your current baby now. But as they say, once an entrepreneur, always an entrepreneur. So why being an employee for so long of a company?
Yeah, it's, you know, I've always been, I would say, like an entrepreneur or entrepreneur, even at Acciona. I, you know, started their energy storage practice at Accenture while I was there my first 4 years of my career. Ended up starting, you know, a few different kind of sub teams or anyway, I wouldn't call them practices. I would call them like interests in certain technologies, which ultimately ended up, you know, creating a lot of thought leadership around the sector for the technology labs. And yeah, I mean, at Tesla, what's interesting about Tesla, I mean, what's not to like? There's a huge mission, a very tangible, visceral mission, a save the planet level mission. You're building products that are at a very rapid pace, you know, with some of the best engineers in the world, with very little meeting overhead, right? You know, often you talk to friends at these sort of large tech companies, and they're spending, you know, 70-80% of their time in meetings, like aligning, where at Tesla, you spend, you know, the inverse of that, probably about 20% of your time in meetings and 80% of your time building. You have a very clear path with the best engineers, with very meaty problems, with a lot of responsibility and accountability. And it's very aggressive tech timelines and really cool technology. So it's like for builders, right? We talked earlier, like I like to build. There's few places that offer more satisfaction and impact than that company. And almost everything that you're doing there involves some level of entrepreneurship. You have to find a market, be that an external product, or there's lots and lots of things that Tesla's doing internally, you know, that I ended up creating the mobile robotics team, developed solutions internally for Tesla, which, you know, when you're talking about dozens of factories around the world, not just final assembly plants, but sub factories and other supporting factories, it's a great customer to have too, because they're also innovative too.
So it sounds like after about 7 years, I mean, anyone could get comfortable and be like, you know what, I'm staying here. You know, I mean, Tesla, obviously, you know, with Elon Musk, you know, one of the best founders of our generation, right? But what would you say push you to say, hey, let's go at it again?
Yeah, I wouldn't say there's any moment at Tesla that's comfortable. I think that's one of the big differences between that company and some of the larger ones, right? Is there's really never comfort. My job at Tesla transformed five different times in ways that I wouldn't have ever imagined. If you would have told me what my career path there looked like, I would have told you like that can't be possible. Okay. I did not join to do robotics and manufacturing. But you know, the company had challenges manufacturing up with that ramp, and so I, you know, like many other of my colleagues, answered the call and helped out, and ultimately ended up taking over the number two bottleneck in manufacturing for Model 3, and then saw a whole bunch of other problems and decided to start up this other team. We were doing well scaling that, and then Elon wants to build a humanoid robot. Like, who saw that coming, right? So was asked to take that over. I like to say, when presented with two doors, like I just pick the door that's open, that's the more appealing, or the one that I'm being shoved through and kicked through effectively. that's a little bit of what that career was like. You know, to answer your question, why did I leave? Ultimately, everyone's got a finite tenure there. You get tired of the culture or, you know, Elon gets tired of you, one of the two. Oftentimes they both happen at the same time. You know, ultimately what the humanoid program was building, basically, it's an R&D project. It's a very high pressure R&D project that, is eventually going to yield wild success. I'm very sure of that, as long as, you know, Elon and Tesla stay committed to that. But I'm not sure if that's like, you know, 2 years, 5 years, 10 years, 15 years, right? And so people join Tesla to ship, you know, products to millions of people. Have huge impact, tangible impact versus kind of horse around in a lab. And so I didn't see the products that I was building there getting outside of a lab or internal, you know, very limited internal test bed for quite some time. And so, compared to the pressure, we had, you know, small kid on the way. just was kind of the right time to apply my skills elsewhere.
Hey guys, so pardon the interruption here. So I got to tell you that, you know, for those of you that are either looking to raise money or you're looking to get your company acquired, you don't have to be alone. You know, there's a lot of psychology that needs to be blended with strategy, with methodology, with process. And it's very hard. And already doing your business alone is super, super difficult. So I remember, you know, back then when I was an entrepreneur, I kept really experiencing the challenge of either knowing or finding the right type of access to the right type of investors, or really understanding what was the right type of guidance, you know, that would carry me through the process, whether it was with seeking money or with going through the acquisition. So that gap that I found being an entrepreneur is ultimately what pushed me later on when I met my co-founder at Pantera, Mike Severson, to really put together an advisory firm where we are guiding entrepreneurs and founding teams through the capital raising efforts, whether you are at a seed stage or at a Series A stage, or if you are going through the process of an acquisition and you are in small to mid-cap type of a cycle. So again, you know, we would help you from guiding you and supporting you from A to C all the way to the end as an extension of your team. And there's no reason for you to do this alone. So with that being said, if you would like to find out more, feel free to send me an email at alejandro@panteraadvisors.com. And we would love to take a look at helping you out.
So then let's talk about Mitra. So how does the idea of Mitra come knocking and tell us about how, you know, the whole thing came together?
Yeah. So, you know, one of the shocking things that we learned at Tesla was the automation equipment, the conveyors, the elevators, all the programmable logic controllers, the software, the sensors, all that stuff, the degree of complexity almost killed the company, right, across a few different manufacturing lines. And the rapid pace at which Tesla was innovating and changing the product and changing the process was fundamentally incompatible with, and still is kind of today, fundamentally incompatible with the current state-of-the-art technology. And that's why not only is Tesla iterating internally, but you're also shaping the product, designing the product in ways that probably are inefficient just to comply with the manufacturing processes. And so, you know, after Tesla reflected on the 7.5 years there and looked at what are the most, you know, important critical problems that I can solve that are also not moonshots, right? That are very real problems. And when you look across the industrial space, material flow, moving material around the four walls of the factory or warehouse is about 80% of the work in a warehouse and about 40% of the work in a manufacturing facility. And it's a very, very simple task. It's just moving things around. Tesla has all like people, forklifts, pallet jacks, all sorts of, you know, hundreds of different kinds of machines to do this, when we believe that if you take a first principle approach, just like Tesla does to many of its products, all you're doing is shifting things around in 3D space. So if we could come up with the simplest piece of equipment to do the most amount of work, you could create a significant disruptive product to not only serve the Teslas of the world, but, you know, warehouses and manufacturing facilities globally, 90% of which choose not to apply any technology or very little automation or technology to their businesses right now. Imagine if you were on the market for a Toyota Camry or car, mid-sized car, and you go to the auto show and you have a Formula One race car and a horse. Those are your two options, right? Most people choose the horse because they can at least maintain it, right? Very few people have the technological skill or fortitude or patience to be able to maintain a very high precision, complex, bespoke asset. And that's effectively what industry is left with today. So if we can come with the Honda Civic or Toyota Camry, or I guess the Model Y, which is one of the best selling cars in the world today, we can make a big impact. And that's what we're doing.
So then let's talk about what ended up being the business model now of Mitra. How are you guys making money with it?
We're basically selling a vertically integrated material flow system, or a vertically integrated material flow, basically a hub for material. Think as material goes into your warehouse or manufacturing system, you can put it right in this system. If it needs to be presented for quality control, or it needs to be stored for long duration storage, or if I need to send it over for, you know, other kitting processes or receiving, it serves as kind of the cardiovascular system for your facility. It includes the structure, so the steel kind of racking structure, and includes a robot that moves up, down, left, right in all directions up to 3,000 pounds, because the industrial pallet, which weighs up to 3,000 pounds, is your common denominator across supply chain. And then it includes the software that manages all that. And it's really just that, like the bot is the only actuated, you know, powered, sensed, you know, instrument in the system, apart from some interface stations. And the rest is just steel. The business model is, you know, customers will buy and install the steel structure, and then the robot can be bought or can be effectively leased. And then the software is licensed. And then if, you know, customers want sort of a bumper to bumper maintenance or warranty program, that's something that that we're happy to work with them on as well.
So now, how much capital have you guys raised to date, Chris?
$78 million across three price rounds.
And how has it been the journey going through the motions there and raising that money?
It's never easy. These types of capital markets, you know, when you're building a company like ours, but fortunate to have you know, great conversations with Eclipse early on, and you know, they're very you know, back in 2015 they were saying, you know, industrial and supply chain and manufacturing is going to be a huge opportunity for investment, and I think people laughed them out of the room, and it turns out they were right. This is a huge area of investment, and lots of money is flowing into this now. It was great connecting with them, and they had a very similar vision for what we're building at Mitra. They just needed a team to execute it. And so we're a bit kind of two peas in a pod there. And then the Series A and B came together, you know, as we were meeting our milestones. Both rounds came together a little bit ahead of time. And, you know, our goal is to continue to execute according to the plan. And, you know, if you're doing that with a large market, building a great team and delighting your customers, you know, the funding will be there.
So then in this case, I mean, what do you think, you know, it has taken to really build a world-class team?
It's one of the hardest things in robotics and in deep tech more broadly, partially because, you know, to build an integrated hardware software company, you know, you need a variety of different engineering disciplines, especially around the hardware areas. Building the wrong thing or building it inefficiently can be, can cost the company a lot, cost you a lot of time. You know, if your company is 6-12 months late delivering on a thing, you could run out of runway in that time, or and or lose confidence in customers and effectively activate the death spiral. So, you know, finding these leaders that are, you know, at least 5, if not 10 to 15 or 20 years of experience to lead each of these engineering disciplines is not a nice to have, it's a must. And if you're just kind of graduating, you know, college and thinking like, I'm going to recruit, you know, 7 world-class leaders across these different disciplines. I don't know, maybe you know them, maybe you've got family friends, or, you know, maybe you've got great relationships with their professors, university or something like that. But I didn't have that coming out of undergrad. I didn't even know what venture capital was coming out of undergrad, much less have the wherewithal to build a team like this. So it does take a bit of experience. And, you know, these people aren't going to just jump ship. I mean, if they're high performers at their existing company, they're probably getting paid a lot of money, and they may have like families and small kids or something like that, right? So they're not interested in taking a massive pay cut for a big risk. So they need to have that personal relationship. They need to be able to trust you, your vision. They need to believe in the market, and they need to believe in the peers that they're joining around them can execute on this. So that's tough, right? That was my biggest point of, you know, internal contention, which is, can I build this team? Fortunately, at Tesla, I was able to work across a variety of these different disciplines. You know, I was on the interview panels for mechanical, electrical, software, you know, these AI positions, et cetera. So at least I knew kind of what good luck. I knew how to hire, and I knew a variety of people in these positions at Tesla and that worked for me and my team. But there's still no guarantee, like, you're going to be able to pull these people from across industry. Unfortunately, we've we've got a great team on board now. We just made three great hires in the last few months that really kind of solidify the leadership across all the key disciplines. And they work really well together. We like working with each other. We have a lot of fun, and it's harder than the product to build is to like build that core team. That is, again, going back to Lean Startup, your goal is to learn and to build a team that can build the products. You're building the foundation to then, you're in building a house, right? Half the work is like underground. You don't see it, right? It's just not readily apparent, but if you don't build a solid foundation, that house is going to come down real quickly. We've got an extremely solid foundation, and the rest of the house or structure going up. It's not going to be easy, but we've got the right ingredients to do that here.
So you were talking about vision earlier. I want to double click on that. So imagine if you were to go to sleep tonight, Chris, and you wake up in a world where the vision of Mitra is fully realized. What does that world look like?
Ooh, exciting question. It's that vision. So instead of 10% of manufacturing warehousing facilities, being reasonably automated, you're waking up where, instead of people schlepping things around and going around and picking up cases of soda in an aisle, they're doing the things that they should absolutely be doing, which is focusing on edge reasoning, manipulation type tasks, really high value tasks that are generally more gratifying to humans. We have cut the shipping, the development, the turnaround cycle of supply chain. Like, we are storing and probably have 25 to 40% fewer things that are stored in the supply chain because we know where our stuff is. We have less grocery, outage or things are getting to your house faster because you're spending less time in a warehouse and more time, going straight from farm to table. You're building products at a much faster rate because your supply chain is much more efficient. The age of people wanting their products delivered in a day, that's just the tip of the iceberg. People want their products manufactured. They want their products iterated on, faster and faster and faster. So, we're going to wake up in a world where some influencer on TikTok or whatever the platform is holds up some object, and then, a week later, you've spun up a manufacturing system and a supply chain around that can manufacture millions of these units. And that just isn't possible today. So it's going to be a much more efficient world, a much more happy world, because people will be doing jobs that they enjoy. And it's going to be a much more, fast world. It already is faster, but technologies like Mitra are just going to make it faster and faster.
Amazing. So now, let's talk about the past, but doing so with a lens of reflection. Let's say I put you into a time machine and I bring you back in time, maybe to 2011 or 2012, where you were maybe enjoying a glass of tinto, of red wine in Spain, where you were living at the time. And let's say you're able to show up, in one of those tables, having some tapas, and you're able to have a chat with your younger self. And being able to give that younger Chris one piece of advice before launching a company, before you even, started, and became an entrepreneur, what would be that piece of advice and why, given what you know now?
It's tough. I couldn't be more excited to be leading Mitra in the position that I'm in now, and, with the family in San Francisco. So I wouldn't want to give myself advice that would fundamentally deter my course of action. But, one thing that I learned at Tesla was, that company will take everything that you give it. And it took me a few years to kind of figure this out, which is, it's important to draw boundaries. And once you draw those boundaries, it's actually, you can truly work smarter, not harder. Doing more design reviews, being a little bit more analytical instead of just ready, fire, aim, is something that I think could have applied to all of my roles, including my role today. And made them a little bit more efficient, and also just kind of helps with maintaining a level of grounded and just like happiness and optimism versus just like, oh my God, I can't see it. There's no light at the end of this tunnel here. Engineers love constraints, right? If I give you an open-ended engineering problem, you're going to spend the next 5 years trying to build the thing. If I give you like a bunch of constraints around it, you're going to be able to iterate something in like 3 months. And so putting those constraints around time, around like, if you only had one iteration of this, how would you design it versus if you had five iterations of this, right? I think can provide a bit more grounding and focus to solve not every answer, but the most important answer is to allow you to make the most efficient decisions.
Amazing. So Chris, for the people that are listening that would love to reach out and say hi, what is the best way for them to do so?
Well, hello at Mitra.ai is generally the place to reach our company. I get a lot of spam, so I probably won't send you my individual email, though most folks know how to, you know, dissect or reverse engineer email addresses. And I'm always happy to, give advice to folks who are, looking to transition into careers in robotics or even renewable energy. And of course, if you're passionate about manufacturing, supply chain, and the application of robotics and software to this sector, which I did not appreciate before 2017 and now fully appreciate now, we'd love to hear from you. Whether I can be helpful or whether you're potentially a good fit for my trip, please reach out.
Amazing. Well, Chris, thank you so much for being on the Dealmaker Show. It has been an absolute honor to have you with us today.
Thank you, Alejandro. Nice speaking with you.
If you like the show, make sure that you hit that subscribe button. If you could leave a review as well, that would be fantastic. And if you got any value, either from this episode or from the show itself, share it with a friend. Perhaps they also appreciate it. So also remember that if you need any help, whether it is with your fundraising efforts or with selling your business, you can reach me at alejandro@pantheraadvisors.com.
You've reached the end of another episode of the Dealmakers podcast. For free resources and materials, head over to alejandrocremades.com. Thank you for listening, and see you at the next episode.